Well, we're going to spend a little bit of time in this passage. Now, before I begin, one or two things to say. One is, I know from this morning, one or two people had some questions or issues that were raised by what we were talking about this morning, and there may be further things from this evening. So if I manage to get through what I've got here in reasonably good time, maybe there'll be opportunity to ask those questions and have a bit of discussion before we close the meeting with prayer tonight. So that's one thing. And if anything provokes you through the course of the ministry today, you know, think about it and don't be shy. So that's the first thing. And the other thing I wanted to say before I even begin is, looking at this passage, there are some parts in this passage that either I'm incapable of quite fitting it all together, and so I haven't even attempted to, because quite simply, as with the time I've had and my own gifts or abilities, there's just some things in here that I'm not going to pretend to try and square it all away. And I'm just going to treat with what I can do. Do you know that's what I'm going to endeavor to do? There are some things that I'm not going to be able to do to explain everything here, because I think some of the arguments and the explanations in Leviticus chapter 5 are very, very closely phrased. And sometimes I do, I'll be honest with you, find it hard to follow the exact point. But nevertheless, there are things in here that are straightforward, that I think are clear, and we do need to give our thought to. And maybe some of those mysteries the Lord will reveal to you in the course of this evening, and you'll share it all with us later on. Let's hope so. Now, chapter 5. I want to start with a little model. Okay, a little model, because I'm hoping that this little model might be an aid to us in trying to sort of come to terms with the substance of what we're reading. So I want you to picture now that you're going off shopping to the supermarket with little Johnny. Johnny Israelite, I think we called him last time. We probably won't pursue that all the way through. But little Johnny and you are going shopping to the supermarket together. So off you go to the shops. And you're potting around the aisles and everything's going well. You've come to the checkout, you've paid your bill, and out you come. And lo and behold, Johnny has in his hand something that most definitely is not on the receipt. So somehow, some way, Johnny has managed to take something from the shop. Now, this does happen, as most of you will be aware, right, from time to time. He's got this Mars bar or whatever it is. He evidently did not pay for it. Hasn't been paid for. Now, I don't know what you would do in that situation, what the first kind of things your responses are. Think about it for a moment. But I think one of the first things is to find out, did he actually know that what he had done was wrong? I think that would be quite an important first base to try and establish with him. Has he done something out of wickedness, that he's done something he knows is wrong and done it anyway? Or has he, because you know that's the, you know, you've seen children in supermarkets, haven't you? They're kind of like, they're in the little pram bit at the front, and they're picking up all this stuff and they have no idea, they're just putting all the stuff in the trolley, right? And you end up buying it. So I think it's quite important to know, is this a sin? Or is this, and this is the word we need to sort of grab hold of, is this a trespass? Because the Bible makes this distinction between sins and trespasses. Sins are those things that we know are wrong, but we do them. Trespasses are also sins, because it's exactly the same thing. But the difference is, you didn't know, you didn't intend to do it, and that's the distinction. Now, I might be making that distinction too clearly, too boldly, but the thing, they're all sin, they're all under the heading of sin, but a trespass is distinguished by the fact that you didn't mean to, or you didn't actually realize what you were doing was wrong. So I'd like to know, with little Johnny, did he know what he was doing was wrong? That's the first thing I want to find out before I proceed with him about what to do next. So let's just say we find out that he knew perfectly well that stealing Mars bars from the supermarket was wrong, and he's done it anyway. Presumably, he's going to be punished in one way, shape, or form for this, and he's going to be punished for being a blatant rebel, a rejecter of law, a bringer of disgrace on the family, or whatever. You know, he knows what he's done. You're holding him fully to account, aren't you? And he's being punished in whatever way, but in accordance to that. Because what you're trying to teach him is that crime doesn't pay. Don't go down that line, Johnny, because crime doesn't pay. And I'm going to prove to you, I'm now going to make you pay the price for the crime so that you will learn this lesson. But what if he didn't know? What if he didn't know? What if he had no idea that what he was doing wrong? What would you do next? I suppose the next question you want to ask is this. How on earth can it be that Johnny, who is at X age, still doesn't know that taking something out of a shop is wrong? What on earth's going on here? Johnny ought to be able to know that. Who is responsible? Whose job is it to educate Johnny? Is it my fault? Have I failed to lay down? Have you ever done this as a parent, to self-examine yourself? And you just, is it my fault? Did I not make it clear? Have I not taught this person well enough? Or maybe it's not your child, the school or their parents. Who's to blame? Who's responsible for this child's education, for their moral education? How come they don't even know that stealing is wrong? But maybe there's nobody to blame. Maybe the child is just very, very young and there's nobody to blame. But you'd want to know, wouldn't you, whether somebody else was responsible for this. But let's assume that he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know, and you've worked out that there's nobody else who's responsible for this. He's going to get a scolding still, isn't he? But he's going to get a scolding because the purpose of the scolding is to teach him this time that stealing from the shops is wrong. Right? You don't want him to ever do it again, because one day you might not be there to protect him. He could get in serious trouble. So you want to lay down some ground rules for him so that he knows the difference between right and wrong. Now, is that the end of it? Is that where it's left? You've taught him the difference between right and wrong, or you've punished him for what he's done wrong. Is that the end of it? What would you do next? What's the next thing? You've got to go and put it back, Johnny. You've got to go and say sorry to the shopkeeper. You've got to go and own up, don't you? Right? You've got to go and put things right. But it's very important that if there's a difference between if Johnny is 3 years old or Johnny is five or if he's 15, right? Between what you expect of him in terms of putting it back. I mean, you might say something like, Johnny, go and say sorry, right? And he has to go on his own and go into the shop, put the Mars bar back and say, I took this, I'm sorry, here it is. Or you might say to him, I'll hold your hand, I'll go up to the shop counter with you, and we'll stand there in front of the shopkeeper and say, Johnny has something he'd like to tell you. And Johnny will then say, I'm sorry, and give it back. Or if he's very, very young, maybe or simple or something like that, you would want him to say something like, you go into the shop and you say, on behalf of my son Johnny, I would like to apologize. He's taken this thing and here it is. And you do it for him. Or perhaps you could get him to draw a little picture at home or something like that, or make a little treat, and you go into the shop and you say, look, I'm really sorry about this. There's the Mars bar. He did this little picture. He really didn't mean it. He's learned his lesson. We've been talking about it's not right to steal from shops. All right, so can you see that there are? It's important in an age-appropriate sort of way to try and straighten things out. Is that unchristian? Would you think all that is unchristian? Is that an unchristian way to deal with people? I think it sounds to me generally like pretty good parenting. That seems like pretty good parenting to me, generally. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's generally. But I think that is the pattern that we're reading here in Leviticus chapter 5. That is the basic pattern that we've got here in the passage. So the first three chapters of Leviticus, chapters 1, 2, and 3, were all about sin offerings, weren't they? People know what they're doing wrong, and they are being punished for what they know is wrong. They're having to offer some grain or something like that to try and really make it up. And then they're offering the fellowship offerings in chapter 3 to really make sure that once they've put right with God, they're showing God that they really appreciate having a good relationship with God, and they're getting that relationship put right. Chapter 4, the chapter we've just been looking at before last week, talks about the price of ignorance. There is a real penalty to be paid for not knowing the difference between right and wrong. It can get you into a lot of trouble. And these trespasses that are described there in chapter 4 and into chapter 5, there's no excuse for them. And in fact, people were being fined very, very heavily for not knowing their stuff. And it can cost you very, very dear. But chapter 5, verse 1, asks us this very, very searching question, doesn't it? Assuming Johnny didn't know what he was doing, we have to ask the question, why? Why is he still ignorant? Why does he still not know the will of God? Why has nobody told him? Did nobody see? Does nobody care? Is nobody watching over him? Is nobody concerned for his education to fill in those gaps in his knowledge? And it searches it out, chapter 5, verse 1. If a person sins because he does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he's seen or learned about, he will be held responsible. If you have knowledge, it's a great responsibility, isn't it? Because the moment you empower somebody by sharing your knowledge with them, they go from being a trespasser to being a sinner. But at least it gives them, with that knowledge, the opportunity to know what they're doing, responsible for their own actions, and take charge of their life and do something about it. But while they're just trespassing, they're stumbling around in the dark. And if you know and you can see what they're doing, you've got a responsibility to your neighbors, haven't you? You've got a duty of care to the people around you. You know that on the old battlements and the old walls, there are always watchmen posted. And in army camps, you always have a watchman posted for the guard. You fall asleep on duty. You've heard the stories. It is one of the most severe trespasses of any duty, isn't it, to fall asleep on guard. For when the attack comes, you were on duty. You were supposed to look. It was your charge to check out what was going on. You see that in the Bible, watchmen posted on the walls. Why didn't you cry out? Why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you warn us? Because when the attack came and we were overpowered and we lost all that, whatever like that. Ultimately, whose fault is it? You knew. You should have known. You should have said something. As Christians, we know something about this, don't we? Of the burden and the responsibility of knowledge. There are things that you and I know as Christians that are great responsibilities. And there are people all around us who I think, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that they are still in the dark. They are still strangers to the truth. And I'm not saying that we, have to beat ourselves up because there are still lots of people out there who still don't know the knowledge. But we have to be actively pursuing the propagation of knowledge, making Christ known. Sharing the good news, explaining the will of God, being active and purposeful about this. That's the first thing that strikes me here in chapter 5. I think when I was reading it, one or two of you picked up on it. The implications of chapter 5 and verse 1. We have a duty. We have a duty. And we need to fulfill it. The verse that comes to mind, to whom much is given, much is expected. Now, people can react to that in two different ways. Possibility number one is, to whom much is given, much is expected. So therefore, I will make sure that I don't have too much. I will shrink back into the cloud of ignorance and darkness. I will not take on any responsibilities. I won't study learning because I know that I'll be held to account for all that stuff that I take on. Therefore, I'm going to make sure that I've just got a manageable little pile and that's it. But we've been clearly told in Leviticus chapter 4 that there is no excuse for ignorance. That isn't an excuse. You can't get away with that. You have to pursue knowledge and shoulder the responsibility that that knowledge gives you. As your knowledge, as your wisdom, as your understanding increases, so does your responsibility. That's called life. That's called life. That's called living life and answering the call and doing what you can. And that is being a responsible citizen, if you like, isn't it? A member of society. somebody who is making the absolute best of the opportunities you're given and doing your best, not just for yourself, but for all those people around you. And people do all sorts of things. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure you've seen it as Christians. Even younger Christians who do things and you think to yourself, oh dear, you know. And you know, but they clearly don't yet. Let alone talking about people who aren't even believers yet. And the things that they do and the things that they say. They look, oh, you know, it hurts, doesn't it? When you see some of the things that people say and some of the things that people do. And in verses 2 through to 4, you see this list of these things that people just go touching all these unclean things. Getting involved in all these unclean things. And they're just completely ignorant. They're totally unaware that what they're doing is repugnant to the Lord. It defiles them. It demeans them. And yet they carry on. They carry on. And they do matter to God. They're not matters of indifference. But what we see in verse 3 and verse 4 is that even though he's unaware of it, when he learns of it, he will be guilty. How is he going to learn? How is he going to know? How is he going to find out? What passage am I going to turn to now? Where am I going? Matthew 28, did he say? Go into all the world and make disciples. Yes, that's very helpful. Romans 10, without a preacher, how will they hear? How will they believe on whom they've not heard? Unless a preacher is sent, we've got to propagate knowledge. We've got to propagate the gospel. That's where the word propaganda comes from. It's disseminating information, making Christ known, preaching, proclaiming. Preach it from the housetops. For their sake, but also to cleanse your hands, to fulfill your duty, to do your best. Then they will learn, they will find out when somebody tells them, when somebody shows them, when they read it for themselves, when they come to understand. So we have to be deliberate. We have to be deliberate. I think it's much better, isn't it, that they suffer, if they are to suffer, for sin than for trespasses. I'd much rather somebody in the last day stands before God as a rebellious sinner against God. They knew about Christ. They knew about the gospel. They knew about his offer. And they can stand before God and say, I rejected it outright. And then somebody just standing there, I didn't even know. I didn't even know. I'll be more comfortable in my spirit standing on that day, listening to somebody saying, I rejected this, than somebody saying, I didn't know it, if that person had been near me. Because if a person comes face to face and they're led into knowledge and understanding and appreciation that they have sinned and they have fallen short of God's glory, that might be painful for them to learn and to accept. And yes, it is. We talked about this with innocence. In a way, you've got a kind of, there's the mist that surrounds us. We're innocent of something. And you have to maybe be quite careful about, disclosing and helping them to understand. You know, teaching doesn't mean going at it with a sledgehammer and hammering people down. You sinners, look at all the things you've done. That's not necessarily the way it's done. It may be a very loving, gentle process of just helping somebody to come to terms with who they really are and who God really is. Prayerfully, lovingly, patiently, kindly. But in the end, it's a process that has to be paid, because the good news is, and we were talking about this the other day, learning that you're a sinner, learning that you've fallen short of the glory of God is not the whole story. Because as soon as you understand that, you can find out you can be forgiven. The price has been paid. You learn the bad news so that you can embrace the good news. Spurgeon said, more flies get caught in honey than vinegar. And basically he's trying to say, preach the love of God. Just don't go around dampening everybody down, telling them how rotten, how black-hearted, all the things, and pointing out every single thing they do wrong. They're only learning these things so that they can change, so they can grow, so they can be all that God has meant them to be, so they can know God's love and grace and forgiveness and fly. The love of God. The love of God. So let's be careful about the spirit in which we go about teaching the nations. But it really does raise a question, doesn't it? In verse, this verse 1 raises a question. Not only is it important that we inform people, yes, sensitively, wisely, inform people, break the news to them, share these things to them, but amongst ourselves as Christians. You know, there is a culture, isn't it, that sort of whistleblowing is not really kind of well, it's kind of snitching or whatever, you know. There's a sort of an anti thing, isn't there? But if you see me doing something and you know it's wrong, if you see me doing something and you know it's wrong and it's grievous to God and you're aware of it, I need to be teachable enough to let you come to me and talk to me about it. And even if you're mistaken, let's just have the conversation. If you're right and you can deliver my soul from something, then I will be able to thank you in eternity. And that's the culture we need, isn't it? That nobody is so above the fact that none of us know it all. Does anybody here know it all? No, we don't. So what have we got? We've got nothing to be proud about. We've got nothing to boast about except Christ. So if there's one of us can teach another and help another and lead another, then it's all good, isn't it? It's all good if we can be the sort of people that God wants us to be. But it's a culture, and that culture is being encouraged here in Leviticus, that we should be prepared to learn from one another. Well, that's a good thing, and that we can grow together and please God. That's not quite the end, though. Because in verse 6, we realize that so there are all these sort of little things that people do that are actually quite serious, and they need to come to terms with all that. And if you're aware of somebody else doing it, you have to be prepared to do something about it. But when they know it, we read in verse 6, then there's this little word in verse 6, and a penalty for the sin. It introduces this word penalty. That penalty has not been introduced. And I could probably expand on this much more than I've been able to do. A penalty, a price, some sort of compensation has been, if you've got a King James Bible, have you got a King James? Is it compensation in the King James? Verse 6, yes? Penalties in the NIV. It says atonement, does it, in the King James, in verse 6? Huh? At the beginning of verse 6? At the very opening of verse 6? Penalty? A trespass offering, is that how the way it phrases it? Okay, in a way it's got the word penalty, in another translation it's got compensation. Because as we've said before, it's one thing to find out where you are, find out what you've gone wrong, but you do actually also have to pay some compensation, make some effort to make restitution, to put things right. To put things right. I'm really touched as we look down there in verse 6 that the penalty to put things right again, okay, you didn't know what you were doing, but now you do. Now you've got to put things right. But look at the way these penalties are scaled. In verse 6, if you're a reasonably wealthy individual, it'll cost you a lamb. If you're not so fortunate, verse 7, it'll cost you two turtle doves or two pigeons. But if you really are in a rather sticky place financially, it'll cost you, verse 11, an ephah of flour. So depending on your ability to pay, there will be a penalty is scaled according to your situation. Or in verse 15, it seems pretty clear to me that if you haven't got any of those things in your actual possession, you can pay over the financial equivalent value. So you can pay it over in silver instead. A pile of silver according to that amount will suffice either way. Because you've got to actually go back to God. You don't just learn that what you've done is right. You've got to go back to God, and you've got to go and put things right. You want to get right with your neighbours if you've offended them. You've got to get right with God if you've offended him. And you've got to find some way of making restitution. This in itself is not, you don't do this in order to have your sins forgiven. It's just because it's right, because it's good. It's good for your relationship. It restores your relationship to how it should be. Also notice in verse 16 that there's a 20% admin charge, which is presumably payable to the priest for all the bother that this has caused. They've had to process and deal with this whole business where people should have known, everybody should have known this. We've been preaching this every Sunday. And yet how is it you people still don't know? And you still got into this tangle. So it's going to cost you 20% for the headache. I think that's the impression I get from that. Because it's all about just making sure that everybody, everything is put back in place, everything put back in order, that anybody's been put out by what you did, though you didn't know it was wrong, everybody's arms have been smooth, everything's fine, God's all right, you're all right, the people around you are all right, and you're ready to move on. And we want to see that, don't we? We want to see when people are coming to God, learning of God, that they didn't just realize they've sinned and even realize they've forgiven, but then begin a relationship with God where they actually show in their lives as they're able to. And people are able at different levels, in case you haven't noticed. You know, not everybody's the same. But as much as they're able to actually engage in a relationship with God and demonstrate to him that he matters to them. And a right relationship with him and the people around them matter to them. That's what we want as the basis of Christian fellowship as well, isn't it? Well, that's the sum of my thoughts, really, from this. There are various things in there. I think there are probably some quite important things that I just haven't even touched on from it all. There usually are in these great passages of Scripture. But there it is. It just seems a very good, simple model of just right relationships, isn't it? Something about just keeping short accounts and putting things right with God and with each other.